Mark Motzinger is joining me in the studio this morning. I've already been talking him up if you've been listening this morning. And quite frankly, Mark, I've been regaling members of the staff with stories.
Oh, boy.
I knew you'd like that. Because that's how long Mark and I have known each other. Probably you and I and Bob Romanowski, of course, who was just in the studio as the chief engineer, have known each other since we were 5 years old.
Probably, yeah.
Five or six years old. Yeah. We've known each other our entire lives. So we know, you know, friends are people who know you and still like you.
That's right.
But, you know, it's interesting, Mark, why I invited you to come in. During the fall this year, I kind of got into a spurt where I was going to a lot of locations, Dixon Springs, Buffalo Rock, Cavern Rock, Garden of the Gods, and I intentionally went to those locations seeking out other people who are here from outside of the area, which is easy enough to do in the parking lot.
Yes.
You just look at the plates, Indiana, Missouri, Kentucky, Wisconsin, right? And and without question, every one of them said, oh, this is a really cool place. What else is there? And I started bringing up your work to them, and unanimously, they were all like, really, where are these at? There's an interest in what you've done. It's so new. People have known about it in isolated senses, but you're doing a more comprehensive work on this. And what we're doing is called the Mysterious Walls of Southern Illinois.
Yes, Mysterious Stone Walls of Southern Illinois, yes.
And you started this work, well, you got the award from the Historical Society in 2014. And you'd done work prior to that. How long have you been working on this?
Well, it's kind of hard to say because I've been interested in them for years. My dad was one of those kind of guys that liked to go out and took me out in the woods. And I can remember as a small child going up to the top of Stone Fort Bluff and bouncing up the hill in his old, he had an old Rambler with no back seat. And going up there and looking around. And so I've kind of had an interest for years. But when I started teaching at Cary Mills Stone Fort, high school in 2003, I kind of got interested in some of my classes on kind of explaining to the kids why the town of Stone Fort, which is Cary Mills Stone Fort High School, was called Cary Mills Stone Fort. And when I got to checking in for sources and things to teach them about the Stone Forts, I found out that there was really not a lot of stuff out there, and what was there was kind of individualized. There might be something about Giant City Stone Fort, there might be something about the Stone Fort Bluff, but there was really not anything that really brought them all together. And the next thing you know, it kind of morphed into an obsession.
All right, now I have a struggle with this. I have and it's because of Stone Fort. I have never been to Stone Fort. My education is lacking. But I've always thought of it as a fortification because of the term. A lot of people don't know why it's there. Your work has been on walls. Is Stone Fort one of the walls, or is it a different thing?
It is one of the walls. However, it's shaped a little different than all the other ones, but it would definitely be considered one of the walls. There has been some archaeological work there done by the Shawnee National Forest and by the Illinois Center for Archaeological Investigations at SIU, and they have basically dated them back to what they call the Late Woodland Period, which would be 400 to 800 A.D., and that's basically when they find that most of these walls were all built about that time. So, yeah, they are tied in.
And the question is, because when you look at the activity during this time period, mounds and what probably would have been the most populous city in North American continent during this time period, and that is more of a earthwork,
right.
Right, as opposed to these items that are in our area, which are stone walls. And that's the thing. Every time I talk about it, when I'm sharing this with people, I have a tendency to want to describe them as a fortification.
Well, that's a very common thing, and one of the reasons that they call them fortifications is when some of these, and you can actually date them when they were first seen or first written about by what they call them. The ones that are the older ones are all called stone forts because the people that came into the area at the time, you know, they were thinking of Indian problems. The pioneers that came in were, you know, worried about different things. And so when they saw things, they saw them as forts. A little bit later.
Because like, they were militarily disposed to think of them that way because they were on their heels defensively.
That's exactly right.
They predisposed themselves to an outcome.
And then later on, when you start seeing them in the later 19th century, when they start finding them, they start looking at them as pounds. Were they, you know, a place to keep, you know, the agricultural society, people that had, you know, fences and that type of thing. They started seeing them that way, so they started calling them pounds. And then later on, they just referred to them as walls. So you got forts, pounds, walls, and basically they're all the same thing.
All right. You talked about shapes.
Yes.
I mean, because when I think of a wall, once again, my predisposed outcome is a straight line, this one line of or stones.
Yes. Basically, if you could just envision the state of Florida and the water line, the ocean line or Gulf of Mexico being bluffs and the Georgia border being where a rock wall was built. That's the way most of them are. However, the one at Stone Fort Bluff is on a straight line bluff with a kind of a semicircle or half circle rock wall. So it's a little different.
All right. So am I envisioning this now? Correctly or incorrectly, here's the point. I've got a bluff or some type of natural structure that stops the bad guy from getting me from the back.
Yep.
And then I build a wall. I've got something safe to cover my back, and then I build something in front to keep myself safe.
Yes. Basically,
or to enclose animals.
Basically. Or enclose animals or for ceremonial purposes.
Which is your theory.
Yes.
What do you base your theories now that this had a ceremonial significance or a meeting place significance?
Right. The reason I do is, and what a lot of people don't realize too, is that these walls actually predate most of what the structures like you see with Cahokia and those type of things. And if you ever go to Millstone Bluff, the signage up there is completely wrong. They've got the wall in a kind of around the top of it. It actually goes across in a straight line at Millstone Bluff. And the village site up there is actually hundreds of years after the wall. And probably the people that built the village, the Mississippian people, probably tore a lot of the wall down for their purposes. I believe I've kind of got a unique experience. I spent quite a bit of time in West Africa. And matter of fact, I lived there and taught there, and I see some of the structures that they have built out of natural things, and it's usually, you know, trees, and they'll put like a thorn wall. They don't have a lot of rocks in this area, and they'll make like a place that says, okay, when you go inside here, this is a sacred special place. And I kind of see how they use those, and it just makes sense to me.
Yeah. It's interesting because what you're talking about is, you know, taking the thorn bushes in Africa that you create a safe enclosure, right?
Exactly.
And I think you kind of project a spiritual nature on this because I've read several pieces of psychology on this about people's, especially our generation,
mm-hmm.
that the theory being that a man and a woman and their children are back in the bottom of a cave.
Exactly.
And they hear something outside, and there's two groups of two kinds of human beings. The one that says, oh, it's nothing, and rolls over, and then whatever makes that sound eats you. Or the one that goes, holy cow, what is that? I need to go out there and deal with that and protect myself. And then very often the human mind projects on that something gave me a warning or a heads up. And a lot of people feel that there's two types of human beings. So you've got this one that, you know, in a safe spot, there's a spiritual significance assigned to that.
Exactly. And, you know, and if you look at all of the structures that we have from the ancient world that a lot of time was spent to build, and you got to really stop and think about this, the amount of time to build these walls, it's estimated they were between 6 feet tall and 6 feet wide in a lot of places.
Wow.
That's a lot of rock.
Especially when you look at the size of rocks that were used.
Yes. They're all between about 50 and 100 pounds. You know, rocks.
Don't you find that interesting?
Yes, I do.
Because when I look at the pictures that you sent me from the sites, the uniformity in size and shape struck me, even though they're not blockish by any stretch of the imagination. They haven't been milled, have they, in
no,
any way?
None of them have been milled. There is no mortar involved. It's all just free stacking, which makes the wall at Stone Fort Bluff very unique in the fact that it is the only one that we have that predates the New Madrid earthquake that somebody actually saw and recorded.
So that 1811 then?
1811, 1812 of December and January of 1811, 1812. There was a survey done by the Illinois, when they did the surveying of Illinois while it was still a territory, and the surveyor actually drew a diagram of the Stone Fort at Stone Fort Bluff, and described it as 6 feet tall and 6 feet wide. And that is the only one we have that predates that. And if you ever go to some of these, you can really see the rubble that has fallen down the hill. And you could imagine if an earthquake was shaking the church bells in Philadelphia around here, they shook all those rock walls down, and that's why it's important.
All right. Are the other 11 walls, is that the current count, or has it gone up?
Well, it's kind of confusing because there was a period there where they actually thought that there was one that had two different names, and some people had it listed as two different places. Then it came down to that there were 10. And then in about 2012, while going through some old newspaper articles and some old writings from a guy by the name of Elo Trigg, who most people in Southern Illinois
are
familiar
with. Which I want to
ask
you about later.
Yes. And going through some of those, he just has a little tiny brief mention of a stone wall. And he has a lot of those. People would give him information about different places, and he'd go look, and he'd say, well, this is neat. This looks like a camel. Or, wow, this is neat. This looks like an anvil. So a lot of the places we have were from his correspondence. Well, there are several places where he said, I'm going to go investigate the stone wall. Well, I would go and look, and it would basically be a stone burial mound or something. But when I went and looked at this one, this was a wall that had never been recorded, and it's on Murray Bluff. And so in 2012, we basically, or I found an 11th wall.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Your wall. We can call it Motzinger's wall?
Well, yeah, they call it Murray Bluff.
Okay, Murray's Bluff. Was there a consistency in design, length, width, from wall to wall to wall?
No. Probably they basically fit wherever they are. So if the span, from the armpit of Florida there on the Gulf over to the Atlantic was, in 100 miles, the wall would be 100 miles. No,
right.
That's not how
to
much
whatever,
it would be. But
to whatever,
whatever
covers
yes.
the gap up yeah. and keeps you safe, which comes back to
exactly. the... Exactly. Now, the largest area is at Pounds Hollow, and there's about 40 acres inside of that one. And the wall, runs about 300 and something
wow.
feet.
Well, this comes back to that takes a whole lot of man hours.
A whole lot. And see, and that is another
issue. And the
large
population probably.
Exactly. Too. And that is another issue that I kind of see as the ceremonial purpose, because what they have done is a sacrifice of time. And so the sacrifice of putting that much work into it is almost an homage and a ceremonial type thing as
what
well.
What did they have to protect themselves from at that point? Other Indians?
Very interesting that you would ask. There's a lot of different theories. As far as the fort possibility goes, the type of warfare at that time, the bow had just been started using the bow. The insides usually don't have any water access or anything like that, so it'd been kind of a last-ditch suicidal place, like a Masada-type place.
Right.
But that is probably kind of, in my opinion, kind of rules out the idea of a fort. What were they protecting themselves from, you ask? Well, if there's some ideas that it was an attempt at, now I'm going to get kind of all coast to coast here on you. There's some ideas that it was possibly a place where they attempted to contact the spirit world, like a portal or a gateway type thing.
Right.
There's also some belief, too, that, and this is my theory, and be quite honest with you, I'm putting it out here probably the first time right now. But in about the time period that we had that these walls were built, we had 2 years that were, when we look back in the historic data, was known as the years without summer.
Yes, I know, the years without summer, right.
And that coincides with the fall of the Roman Empire, the beginning of the Dark Ages, the rise of Islam, all different types of things. And one of my theories...
Mini Ice Age.
Exactly.
Is what they were talking about.
And basically what you had was two extremely large volcanic eruptions, that one at Krakatoa and one down in El Salvador, and that could possibly have blotted out the sun for almost 2 years. One of my new theories that I'm kind of working on is that it was possibly they were building these places as ceremonial spots to try to contact the spirit realm to appease them to help bring the sun back.
Right. And this is interesting because this mini ice age had large political, military implications across the entire world. It really doesn't get spoke of early enough. And, of course, the year without summer was also how Southern Illinois was referred to, came to the name of Little Egypt.
Yes. And that's two different time periods.
But
One of the things that we can do is look at that time period when we did have people here and kind of compare it to what it would have been like back then. And the time period of about 535 AD, that time period, the years without summer were even worse than what we had. And you see the upheaval that it was caused. You could see these people getting desperate.
Right. And especially when you're living on thin margins.
Exactly.
You're an inherently agricultural society. You're nomadic. You may be growing a few crops, but chances are there's some nomadic components there. You mentioned a name. And it's interesting because when I was sharing your work with some of the visitors of Southern Illinois and their interest, which, by the way, they want to know where they're at so they can go see them, you mentioned L.O. Trigg.
Yes.
Now, and it was interesting because I was talking to a woman. She said, where else can we go? And I said, like, have you ever been to Trigg Tower? No, I don't even know where that is. I said, that's cool. You're probably – Trigg Towers, there's not much of it left, really, compared to what it was historically.
Oh, yeah. It's, yeah, probably
it was
about half.
It was really big, tall, really with a house basically on top to look out of the forest to see if anything was burning. Tell us about Trigg. First, as president of the Historical Society, Saline County, did you get his papers and works? I know you had wanted to acquire them.
Okay, well, yes, we have quite a few of them. And a fellow from Hardin County, Todd Carr, has actually put together a book about L.O. Trigg, and it's available in most of the bookstores around here. And what had happened was several years ago in an estate sales, some of the local guys were able to obtain a lot of the pictures. I actually had a guy walk into my office one day and just said, hey, you like history, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he handed me these two boxes, and he thought, I don't know if this is worth anything or not. Well, to me, it was worth $1 million. You couldn't really sell it for anything. But what I found in there was some of the missing albums, and I have them all now, and a whole lot of the correspondence. And that's the reason I found the Murray Bluffstone Fort.
Good.
But L.O. Trigg was a newspaper guy who actually was from down around Ozark originally. He ends up as the running the El Dorado newspaper, and his family, most of them are all still over there. And he just had a huge interest in Southern Illinois, and this is during the 30s and the 40s. And he had I've actually owned some of his business cards that said salesman for the Illinois Ozarks, but not in a real estate business.
I get that, too. You do, too.
Yeah.
Because that's what you're doing, and to a certain extent, that's what I'm doing, selling Southern Illinois to other people. Come here, enjoy what we have. It's a great tourist location.
Exactly.
Right? And I'm hoping you and I get a chance to talk about Trigg, because he's one of the underappreciated, you know, people that you've got. You know, you got the guy, gosh, that did all the photographs of Yellowstone, right?
Yep.
I'm trying to remember his name, and it's not coming to me quick enough.
Muir or something like that.
No, it'll come back in a minute, I hope, just about 5 minutes after you leave.
Yeah.
And this, Trigg was that guy for Southern Illinois. You mentioned earlier that he had these descriptive names, the locations, that have stuck to this day.
Exactly. And what he did was he created these tours, and his basic idea was he wanted a national forest. And he is basically the father of the Shawnee National Forest. Without him, it may have not been there. He started out as what he called a reforestation project, because so much of Southern Illinois had been farmed in areas where probably shouldn't have been farming, and the soil wasn't deep enough, and it eroded, and it wasn't good anymore for
anything. Hard to imagine Southern Illinois, no white-tailed deer, no trees, lumbered down to the ground. There are some places that me and my buddy Red go to Johnson County, and we call them the Christmas tree farm. And then you look in the corner, there's a stone from the core that these trees were planted with the money from the Daughters of the American Revolution. And you go walking or deer hunting through there, and every tree is in a straight row, and they're all the same height.
That's exactly right.
It's very kind of hard to imagine for people of our age and younger in particular, that you can look out in Southern Illinois and realize there were no trees. We took them down to the nubs.
If you go to a place where there's a lot of pine trees, that was at one time probably either a cornfield or a hayfield.
Yeah, and still see those stone piles sometimes
exactly.
In woods because it had been a field and they'd taken all the stones and put them off the side. The people who I've spoke to about your work, they really want to see what it looks like.
Right.
It's hard to appreciate. You can't, because it's so big, it is so old, until you're there and you walk around it, you can't really appreciate it until you're there.
That's exactly
what would somebody who's listening right now wants to go see one of these. Where do you send them? Giant City?
Okay, the two best places and the two easiest places to get to would be Giant City, the Stone Fort at Giant City, or at Rimrock Trail, the Pounds. Both of those are places that are very easy to access. The Pounds, you can almost, at Rimrock, you can almost drive right up to it. The one at Giant City, you park there at the bottom of the hill and kind of walk up, and you get another good idea. Now, the one at Giant City may be one of the best ones to kind of look at, simply because during the CCC times, they pulled the rocks down and then restacked them. And every one of these places has all kinds of stories. There's gold buried there. There's all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of – that's part of what I'm putting in my book, is there's just so many, you know, legends and lore and all kinds of things about these places that are interesting. And one of the reasons a lot of people think that the CCC guys were sent up there to do this was there had been rumors that there was gold buried there. And so they removed all the rocks and then put them back and restacked them.
All right. No gold, though.
No gold. No gold.
Mark Motzinger, historian, teacher. You still president of the Historical Society?
Yes, I'm actually president of the Saline County Historical Society and on the Illinois State Historical Society board. I'm also on the Saline County Tourism Board and Southernmost Tourism Board.
I knew you had a bunch of those.
Yeah.
And a good guy to begin with to start it all out.
And believe it or not, I'm also the men's basketball coach at Southeastern Illinois College.
You don't have any spare time.
No.
Not really at all.
I wouldn't know what to do with it.
You still running the orphanage in Africa?
Yes.
See, That's the one. I'm really proud of you on that, by the way.
Yeah, that is probably one of my the proudest things that I've done.
Mark and I were in the car, and we're traveling down Route 13, and he's talking to me about his time in West Africa, and he says, you know, and he's describing where he lives inside this block building, right? And there's one window, and he looks at me, he says, when I got back and I looked at my house, I realized how many things we have in our life we don't need.
That's exactly right. You know, until you've been kind of thrust into that kind of an environment, you don't really realize that we just, Americans and Europeans are the same way, we just have a lot of stuff.
We really do, and that you don't need it all. And
that's
one
right.
of my things I've learned from you, too. Miss your dad every day, too, right? Virgil?
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
I was telling the story about how your dad saved our lives.
We had drowned.
Mark and I were Cub Scout kind of troop leaders within the troop, and we had two sides, and he was a leader of one, and I was the other, and we were in the same pup tent at
Teal Pond.
Teal Pond, and yep. A large storm came, and we had put our tent in a gully. Looked good, though, in the daylight.
Well, it was nice and flat.
It was flat. It's from the water washing it out, and that was where... And here comes a wall of water and a huge storm, and Virgil Motzinger reaches inside the pup tent, which would have been our coffin, and grabs us by whatever night clothes we have on and throws us into the back of a pickup truck and saves our lives. One of my favorite all-time stories, buddy.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark Motzinger. Man, it's so good to see you, pal.
You too.
And good luck. When's the book coming out?
I'm going to be retiring at the end of the year, and I'm going to try to get it finished up this summer.
I'm looking forward to seeing it, too. You got a name for it?
Mysterious Stone Fortifications of Southern Illinois.